And then this is going to be on page 918 of the Bibles in the pews. And if you don't have a Bible, we would love for you to take one as a gift from our church. I, therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. But grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men. In saying he ascended, what does it mean but that he had also descended into the lower regions of the earth? He who descended is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens that he might fill all things. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ until we all attain to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, so that we may no longer be children tossed to and fro by the waves and carried out by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning, by craftiness and deceitful schemes. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. This is the word of the Lord. And this is my dad.
Good morning, Redemption City Church. That's enough emotion for one day. Let's just go home, right? She even has comedic timing. So proud. There's just nothing better than watching your kids grow up and know the Lord. Sorry. Okay, I'm going to do my best here. Compose myself. As a father, many of you are fathers, and you know this. If you're a dad, you know that you cannot be the father to your kids that they need. So you know they need the Father. And so it is a tremendous blessing when they know him. I'm going to stop talking about that. All right. Good morning. I'm here. I'm focused. I'm with you. We're going to get through this together. I actually want to start out with a question this morning for each one of you. And as I ask this question, I really want you to consider it for yourself. Look into your own heart and think about it. Give it some thought. And the question just is this: why are you here? Why are you in church? Now, for some of you, I know that the answer to that is pretty simple. You say, well, I'm in town with family, or a friend invited me, and that is absolutely wonderful. If you are visiting this morning, we are very glad that you are here, and actually have a special invitation for you as a visitor. I would invite you this morning to eavesdrop. I want you even to snoop a little bit on what is going to be a family conversation for us. Because if you are a member of this church, and by member I mean anyone who calls this church your church home, then we are indeed a family. So when we talk about the church, we are having a family conversation. We're spiritual fathers, spiritual mothers, spiritual brothers, spiritual sisters, spiritual sons, spiritual daughters, and we're going to get into that family conversation today. The question I have is really for the family members here. Why are you here? And I don't just mean, why are you here on a Sunday? I mean, why are you a part of this community? Some of you would say, well, it's just that. I very much want to be a part of a community. I want that sense of belonging, that sense of being known. So Some others of you might say, I want to be taught. I want to be trained. I want to understand the scriptures so that I can have wisdom and know how it is that I am to walk out my life of faith, to follow Jesus in the world. Others of you might say, well, it's worship, it's song, it's prayer, it's communion with God, it's sacrament together with the people of God. And all of those are wonderful answers. They're all right and true and good. But all of those are some of the what. Those are what we do as the family of God. And this morning, I want to push a little bit deeper for our purposes and get to the why. The why behind the what. Why is it that we are here? And so as we get into this conversation, this rather one-sided conversation, I want us to go to the highest why. Okay, there are other little whys, but I want us to go to the highest and the deepest why, the spirit of Redemption City. What is our highest purpose? What are we all about? And in that spirit of Redemption City, I'm going to do something that is a little bit uncomfortable for me, but operating according to the rhythms of our church, I'm just going to spill the beans right up front. I'm going to give you a big idea. Can you believe it? It's typical for preachers at Redemption City to give one. No drama, no tension, no mystery, just the facts, ma'am. Here it is. God is filling the world with himself, and we're his plan. This is his plan. That's the big idea. That's the why behind why we're here. God is filling the world with himself, and this is his plan. This. That's astonishing. We are his plan. A cosmic triune conspiracy to permeate the heavens and the earth with a divine presence and glory that was there before the foundation of the world. And he says, you. I choose you. You moms, you dads, you sons, you daughters, you brothers, you sisters, no matter who you are, no matter what humble origin, I choose you. This is how I will accomplish my grand mission of filling the world with my splendor. Every rock, every stream, every sun, every galaxy will vibrate with the glory of God. So go. Go and do this, he says to us. With a straight face, mind you. This is what the book of Ephesians is all about. This impossibly glorious task that God gives to his people, that God calls his church to be about. Filling the cosmos with himself. If you've been here this summer, you know we're working through the book of Ephesians. And we find ourselves in the text this morning at an inflection point. Because the book of Ephesians really has three parts. And so the first part is the first three chapters. And in the first three chapters of the book of Ephesians, which we've now walked through up to this point, the Apostle Paul, who is the author of this letter to the church in Ephesus, modern-day Turkey, he lays out a theological foundation. That is, Paul gives the news in the first three chapters. Hardly any advice whatsoever. He just tells us what God has already accomplished, that God has accomplished a spectacular redemption through Christ, and that he has now invited his people into the arc and story of that redemption in Christ, that we get to experience that and participate in it. It's just news. It's a glorious theological foundation. God has not just had mercy on us as though we were sort of passive worms in the story. No, not at all. Much more than that, he's invited us right into the center of the story, to be swept up in the story, to participate in the accomplishment of the story, the working out of that great redemption. 2 weeks ago, Alon preached out of Ephesians 3 that through the church, the manifold wisdom of God would be made known to the rulers in the heavenly places,
through the church, the manifold wisdom of God would be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. That is the cosmos, the whole of creation, all of the galaxies, all of the stars, everything that God has made, and all the spiritual beings that dwell there will wonder and marvel at the glory of God because of us, because of churches, because of local churches, a local church even like ours, once lost people, people that were breaking everything that we touched, now drawn into the healing of the very world that we ruined. What a foundation this is that Paul lays out for us in the first three chapters of Ephesians. It's a foundation to build your life on. It's a foundation that you can't help but build your life on, because it's a foundation that bursts with life. Once you're caught up into it, life upon life upon life grows and flows from it. So Paul announces this foundation in the first half of Ephesians, and then at the end of chapter 3, he prays. Pastor Mike preached on this prayer last week. Paul prays that this redemption, this story of God that's been accomplished through Christ, would manifest in our lives, that we'd see it, that all the promises of God would show up in our story, in the churches in Ephesus, and in all the churches that would follow, even here and now in our local church here in Grand Rapids. If you recall from last week, the Apostle Paul prays things like that we would be strengthened with power through God's Spirit in our inner being, that Christ would dwell in our hearts, that we'd be filled with all the fullness of God. You see what he's doing? God is filling the world with himself. God means to fill the world with himself, and he starts with us. He begins to fill us with his fullness, with his presence, with his being, such that everywhere we go and everything we do would be full of the presence of God. We would carry him with us, that his presence would manifest in our homes and in our workplaces and in our marriages and in the mountaintops and in the margins and all of it, that we would be wave after wave, as it were, of divine glory and redemption lapping up on the broken shores of this world, a perpetual sign that God's kingdom is coming, and it will baptize the world as the waters cover the sea. God is filling the world with himself, and he's starting with us. So here we are at this inflection point of Ephesians. Paul's laid the foundation. He's prayed for manifestation. And what's left to do now in the second half of this letter, chapters 4-6, Paul means to now teach us the particular steps of incarnation. How do we now walk this out? We have the news. God's accomplished this. Paul's prayed that that would manifest in us. Now, how do we do it, Paul? How do we walk it out? How does this church, how does our local church, how do local churches participate in a work as grand as this? And Paul's going to go into all the various aspects of our life. How do we walk it out in our marriages and in our families and in our friendships and in our vocations and in spiritual warfare and all these different aspects of what it means to be the people of God? And where does he start this opus of instruction? Where else? With the church, specifically with church life. So that's what we're talking about today. How do we walk out this redemption story together as a church? We start in chapter 4 of Ephesians, the first three verses. Paul writes, "I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." Paul is speaking to the church here, clearly. He's just written of what God has accomplished, what he's called us into. And now he says, walk it out. You've been given new life. You've been given new purpose. Walk it out together, united in peace by the power of the Spirit. Can I say, there are so many opportunities in church life to sow division and dissension. Not sure if you've ever noticed that. There are endless opportunities to sow division and dissension. Why do we sing that song? Why don't we participate in that prayer practice? Why do we have one service? Why don't we have two? Why do we have two services? Why do we spend so much on the building? Why don't we spend more on the building? Can I say, all of these types of questions are very legitimate and quite helpful if they're asked with humility. If you have questions like this of any kind, if you're concerned or wondering, why do we do that and not that? Or my old church did this, or I heard someone say, please come and talk, ask. Our church is in the middle of its own inflection point. Ephesians inflection point, our church is at that point. We're growing, we're expanding. Change and transition is coming. The leaders are praying, but we are going to need to talk to one another. We're going to need to bear with one another, have patience with one another. We're going to need to fail together and learn together and grow together. And so if you have questions, come with that spirit of patience and love and humility. Let's talk those things out together and figure it out together. But what we don't need in this time of transition is foolishness, foolish dissension, foolish division, foolish controversies. And so I want to make a request here based on what Paul is saying in this text. If you hear complaints or accusations swirling around the church, would you be an agent of peace? If there are real hurts to address, broker healing. Bring people together. Pray. Listen. Seek understanding. Bring wise counselors into those things. Talk it through in the power of the Spirit. For my part, I have to confess, that doesn't actually come naturally to me. If I hear foolishness or I hear complaining, my heart starts to beat. My whole body gets tense. I'm actually ready physiologically to go to war. All right, we're going to teach these wrongdoers a lesson and drive them out of the midst, and no more sheep will be hurt. Okay, I need to take a deep breath, right, and realize that the Spirit of God is alive in me, that I am not bound by the weakness and folly and foolishness of my flesh, and I don't have to operate in that. I can walk in the power and wisdom and patience and love of the Spirit after I take that deep breath, right? Some of you, like me, lots of breathing, lots of Spirit. That's what Paul is saying here. You've been given the power of the Spirit. Walk in it. There is so much unity for us to access because of what God has done. Verse 4, listen to this. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. The church is one body, filled with one Spirit, following one Lord, undergoing one baptism. One God and Father over us all. We're children of Him. The unity available to the church is otherworldly. Unity in this world, most often, it's completely dependent on agreement. People in our world find unity. They line up in tribal identities because they see eye to eye on something. They share a political viewpoint or an aesthetic sensibility, or they have the same taste in pie, whatever it is, strawberry rhubarb, best. You're wrong. Unity rooted in agreement is weak because our perspectives change. They fluctuate. We have whims. But it's the best this world can offer. We have so much more. Our unity is not based on our perspectives. It's not based on agreement. It's not based on our whims. We serve one unchanging God. We sit under one Lord. You know what that means? We can disagree under the lordship of Jesus and remain united. We can see things differently under the lordship of Jesus and remain connected. We can have unity and union even as we're working it all through. Even in the mess of failing and learning and growing and seeing it differently. So many of the views that you hold today, young people under the age of 25, I'm specifically speaking to you, you're not going to hold any of them in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Does that mean you have to change churches every 3 years because you have a different perspective? God help us. There'd be no rootedness. There'd be no church. There'd be no communion. Under the lordship of Jesus, we can remain united and move forward together even as we undergo that process with humility and patience and love. This is what's available to the church. What an astonishing offer. Can you imagine if the church global began to step fully into that kind of unity together? What an astonishing witness it would be to the world that has never experienced anything like it. Global unity of that kind, that's beyond our power to affect. We who live here and now, we are limited by time and space. The Spirit will do that work in His time. But we can step into that here. And as much as it depends on us, we can be a church defined by that kind of unity, that kind of communion, that kind of fellowship. That's not easy. We'll have to fight for that. We'll have to walk through hurt and pain to achieve that, but it's been purchased for us. It's ours to realize. What a beautiful thing that would be. And I think we're on our way. As I get to know more and more of you, become more and more familiar with the whole of the texture of our congregation, I think we're on our way. God is doing beautiful things in this church. You can see it in the ways that we care for each other. You can see it in our zeal for the word, in our training up of new leaders. God is building something beautiful here. And I want to encourage you, there's so much more. We're on our way. Whenever we gather here on Sunday mornings or come to a Saturday seminar or many of the weekday mornings, there's things happening here in the church. Whenever I come and participate in any of those things, I'm so filled up. I'm nourished in Christ. I'm nourished in that spirit of brotherly affection and unity and love and truth. And then I step out of our building or our meeting space, wherever it might be in a home, and I look into the neighborhood, and suddenly my mind is flooded with data. If you've done any research about what's happening broadly in the culture in North America, especially in cities, the skyrocketing rates of anxiety that people are dealing with, the overwhelming amount of people who live in crushing loneliness, overwhelmed by the burdens of life and not having even a single friend to help them carry that, to process that with. So many people living with pain and not knowing where to turn for healing, numbing it with food or alcohol or technology. People carrying the scars of trauma and no one in their corner advocating, helping them find the help and healing that they need. And I just think, just within a one-mile radius of the places we meet, our building, your home, your workplace, wherever it may be, there are thousands, tens of thousands of people even. What if they knew? What if they knew and experienced the kind of love and communion and belonging that is available among the people of God? What if there was a way in for them? What if they could see that and experience that? How many lives would be transformed? God is asking that of us. He's calling us to that. To see those people as He sees them. To be filled with His heart for them. We want those people to be a part of this, to be a part of the mystery of God, to be caught up in that same story that you and I are caught up in. Don't take it for granted. I remember what it was like to not be a Christian, to be on my own. What a lost place. What a desperate place. What life there is in God. This is what the church is for. This is what God is doing in our midst. You can see it in seed form here and now. When we talk about church, when we talk about God doing this work, best as I can tell, my summation of the Bible teaching on God manifesting himself through his church, in the most broad sense, it's a two-step process. God builds something beautiful in his church, and then he puts it on display. He nourishes his bride. He grows her up into maturity and beauty and glory, and he puts her on display for the world to see, for the world to know, for the world to experience that she is a manifestation of his glory. He builds something beautiful, and he puts it on display. Everything beautiful about our church, everything that we experience that's so rich and glorious and profound and beautiful, it's all a gift from God. It's all the result of his work in and among us. And these gifts are not just for us. They're meant to be shared. They're meant to be put on display. If this is your church, I want you to catch that vision. Catch that vision that there is something beautiful here. How do we take the bowl off our lamp, as it were? I want you to see with eyes of faith, shafts of light shooting out from our community, baptizing the world in the warmth and heat and life of God's presence. So how do we get there? How do we take that bowl off the lamp of what God is forming here? How do we pierce the darkness? Paul spells it out for us in the next verses. Listen, verse 7. But grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gift. Okay, Paul has told us the church has this radical unity in Jesus. We have a spectacular union with Jesus. We have the power of the Spirit. We're being filled with the fullness of God. So how do we take that into the world? Through a whole host of gifts that Christ gives to the people of God. Christ gifts us in unique and particular ways that we might be about this work. Paul says, grace is given to each person according to the measure of Christ's gift. In other words, Jesus gifts people as he wills. He lavishes us with all kinds of spiritual and ministry gifts. And Paul then quotes this passage from the Psalms. In verse 8, he says, for it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives and gave gifts to men. This is taken from Psalm 68, which is a psalm about the triumph of God over his enemies. It's a psalm about God defeating all of the evil and darkness in the world and ascending to the mountaintop, symbolic of his reign over all things. And when God accomplishes that work of defeating the evil in the world, there are spoils of war to be enjoyed. That's the image in Psalm 68. When you win a war, you win all the spoils. God has won the war. He's won all the spoils. In Psalm 68, it actually says that God receives these gifts, these spoils among men. That is to say, he shares these gifts with humanity, with his people, with those who are on his team, with those who enjoy his victory. Here in Ephesians, Paul is making the same point, and he spells out the prophetic connection of Psalm 68 to now the New Testament church reality. God's ultimate victory over corruption in the world was won in Christ, and he now shares that bounty of his victory with the church. That's where these gifts are coming from. They're coming from Christ, who has won the victory for us. And Paul then adds this parenthetical comment about Jesus descending before he ascends back into the heavens. It can get a little bit complicated. There's lots of scholarly conversation about what exactly Paul is referring to here. But the big idea is that Jesus' victory is total. It's cosmic. It's from the deepest depths to the highest heights. Jesus has defeated evil at every turn. In every square inch of his creation, he has set his reign over it. Christ reigns supreme. Verse 10, he who descended is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. There it is. Our big idea for today. God is filling the world with himself. I remember when my family and I first moved to Chicago from our home in Seattle in the fall of 2009. I was 29 years old. I was brimming with confidence. We were heading to Chicago to plant a church. And we were sent from a very large church in Seattle that had a lot of cachet in the Christian world. And so we kind of hit the ground in Chicago with a lot of momentum. I think I had coffee with almost 100 people in the first 6 weeks who wanted to be a part of what we were doing. And then because of that, we were able to parlay that into co-hosting an event. I reached out to the Atheist Society of Chicago, the friendly atheist, Hemet Mehta, and he agreed to co-host a film screening with us. We screened a movie, which was a debate between a pastor and an atheist who traveled around the country debating each other about whether Christianity is good for the world. And we had this big event, and our audience was half Christian and half atheist. We had almost 200 people come out to this theater in Chicago, and we hosted a panel discussion afterward, and people were having all kinds of conversations. And then some atheist got up and said, "So all you Christians say I'm going to hell," and all hell broke loose, literally. And it was glorious. It was church planting, and there was something happening, and it was electric, and there was something in the air. And we launched our church 6 months after landing on the ground. We had about 100 people in that initial launch gathering, and here we go. Wow, look, Mom, I planted a church. And then the realities of Chicago began to set in. The snow and ice melted tragically, and everybody went to brunch or something because no one was left. And I remember that first Sunday in July, our first summer in Chicago, I think we had 6 adults and 8 kids, and the offering was $10. And I thought, I'm not sure I should have signed that 3-year lease for $4,500 for this venue. You know. And I was feeling overwhelmed. Like, what have we gotten ourselves into? And it was about that time that someone gave me a book. By an Old Testament scholar at Wheaton. He's professor emeritus there now, a man by the name of John Walton. He wrote a book called The Lost World of Genesis 1. I recommend it to you. And in this book, he shows that the creation narrative in Genesis 1 actually maps quite well onto God's instructions to Solomon for how to build the temple. And what he draws out is that in the original creation of the world, God was building a temple. In the original creation of the world, God stretched the heavens for his habitation. He was building a cosmos to fill with his presence. The train of his robe fills the temple, Isaiah 6 says. This was the vision from the beginning. The manifest presence and glory of God would vibrate in all the things that he has made, would stretch into every last corner of every galaxy. He built that into the fabric of the whole world. I remember being so encouraged as I read that. I realized Chicago doesn't stand a chance. Chicago was made for God. He built this city to house him. This is happening. The story has been written. We cannot flummox it. We can't undo it. We can't get in the way of it. God will accomplish it. This is something I can give my life to, because no matter how much of it is realized in my time, this is the trajectory of all human history. This is where it is heading. Every last little contribution we make will matter in the end. This is the only thing that matters. And it's the thing that makes everything else matter. It's this thing to pour our lives out for. Adam and Eve, some of you know, forfeited that purpose. They were placed in that original creation, that original temple, to be the priests. God made a temple, and he created humanity to be his priest, to take dominion and rule in his name, to mediate his grace and presence to every aspect of creation. But Adam and Eve, our first parents, they decided not to rule in the name of Yahweh. They decided to rule in their own names, and so forfeited that birthright. But God, right? But God, the scripture says over and over again, in the face of our failure, but God sent a new and better Adam to be a priest in the way that Adam and Eve could not. An Adam to work redemption, to win back what was lost, and to husband his bride rightly, to protect her and nourish her until she's without spot or blemish. That's what Jesus is doing in lavishing us with gifts. That's why our church is full of gifts, because Jesus is a good husband who nourishes and cares for his bride. He's growing us up. He's seeking our good. He's seeking our flourishing. That's what I realized about Chicago. He wove the fabric of the temple into the very city that I was ministering to. He fashioned it from the beginning to be his habitation. And that's true of Grand Rapids. It's true of every city. It's true of the whole of creation. So take heart. God has gone before us. We are walking out a finished work. This past Friday night, the people who gave Eastertide testimonies in our church, some of you recall if you were here during the spring, gathered together for dinner and to share with one another what that experience was like, to stand up here in front of your community and share so vulnerably. And as we went around the table and heard from each person, I was struck by exactly what Paul is speaking about here in Ephesians, gifts, giftings. Our church is brimming with the spoils of Christ's victory. Our church is brimming with gifts, people who have something to minister to one another with. We have been husbanded well, church. I had that same experience that I had on Friday night talking with all those people who shared testimonies. I have that same experience on Wednesday mornings when we get together with the preaching cohort. So many rich gifts in that group. It's stunningly beautiful when the people of a church begin to use their gifts in concert. It's like a symphony of ministry begins to take place. And that's what Paul is praying for at the end of Ephesians 3, for that symphony to manifest. And that's what he's spelling out here in chapter 4. Listen, verse 11. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers. Okay, Paul here lists five ministry roles, each defined by a certain gifting. It's important to note here, he's not giving an exhaustive list of all the ministry gifts. There are many other lists in the New Testament that include far more gifts than just this. But this is not either a random sampling of gifts. This is a particular set of gifts that has a particular purpose. And we read it in the very next verse, verse 12, to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ. Did you get that? God gives these five ministry gifts, these five roles. Why? So that the leaders in the church can do all the ministry? No. So that everyone else in the church can sit back on the sidelines and watch the pros? No. So that the church leaders can equip every single person in the church to do the work of the ministry. These are leadership gifts given for equipping the saints, to train and equip the saints, so that every last person becomes a minister. It's so otherworldly, so divine. God doesn't save people to sit on the sidelines. He saves people to come right into the game, to get involved, to do the work. There is nothing in your story or your person that disqualifies you from being an effective minister in the household of God. To be one with Jesus is to lose ourselves in him, his story, his work, such that his gifting that he has put in us begins to manifest for the good of all. This is what I want you to see. This is the vision I want you to catch. Can you see it? Do you see it happening? Do you look with eyes of faith at our church and see it happening? God has lavished us with these kinds of leadership gifts. Let me just walk through them. I'll walk through each quickly. Apostleship, the gift of apostleship. It's important to recognize that the Apostle Paul is not here introducing the office of apostle. The office of apostle was given to the 12 disciples of Jesus and later the Apostle Paul for a special purpose in the time of the church. Somebody had to write the New Testament and testify to Jesus when there was no Bible. Okay? Here, we're being introduced to the gift of apostleship. The gift of apostleship, which certainly all the apostles had, the gift of apostleship can be had by any person. And the gift of apostleship really manifests in being a movement initiator of kingdom work. Someone who starts new works, who reaches across lines, builds partnerships, plants churches, starts ministries. We have someone like that in our church. I don't know if you know that. Her name is Jamie Bartlett. Every time I turn around, there's someone who's been affected by a ministry of Jamie Bartlett or knows Jamie Bartlett. There are relationships all across this city that she has forged. Dozens of churches partnering together in Care Portal. She started Laundry Love. She'd be embarrassed to hear me saying all this, but I asked her if I could, so it's her fault. There are other gifts in our church as well. What about prophets? Prophets are the mouthpieces of God's blessings and curses. They bring God's truth into the culture. They engage with the broader culture, and they engage with the broader culture on its aspects of wisdom and folly. They speak words of warning, apologetics, and validation. They call balls and strikes in the culture. I believe that my primary area of gifting is in this category of prophetic speech. I think Mike Bartlett as well is gifted in this. This is something that our church needs to step in more of. Like the gift of apostleship, it's a culture-facing gift. It's a gift that brings the church into the world and engages in the marketplace. How about evangelists? These are people who naturally build relationships with non-believers and then often get to usher those people from unbelief into life with Jesus. We have some evangelists here. Ken Wiest, it was mentioned earlier, leading a person to Christ in Turkey who now is the leader of a movement in Turkey. Luke Start, some of you know, I didn't ask Luke if I could mention you, but Luke holds Bible studies with his friends and sees people come to church who haven't been to church in years. Sometimes forgiveness is better than permission. Shepherds, we have so many people who operate in this gift of shepherding in our church. These are guides who give counsel for life, who protect the sheep, who minister healing to those who are hurting. John and Sarah Holderbaum, to just be in their presence is to experience healing. Zach Harris, Lene Cruz, these are people who minister to us richly. Teachers, some scholars think this may be attached to the shepherd gift. It might be one gift, shepherds and teachers. I don't think so. I think there's a different gift here. They're related, but there's something extra. Teachers expound the word. They make it plain. They unpack its treasures and so train us in righteousness. I think of Susie Mahari. I think of Jim Panaggio, who just so happened to be the leaders of our women's and men's Bible studies, respectively. This fall, those Bible studies are going to work through the book of Acts because we want to learn from the Spirit, the Spirit's work in the early church. How can we learn from that? How can we grow in that? We want to grow in participating in this astonishingly kind and patient plan of God to use humble churches like ours to fill the world with himself. This is where we're going. It's where he's taking us. God is giving us himself, so much so that we would become the very person of Jesus to the world, that he would manifest himself through us. So listen to me. Go all in. If you're someone who's been sitting on the sidelines, what are you waiting for? There is training. There is equipping. Speak to a leader. Ask to learn. Join a Bible study. Join a community group. Get involved. Participate. Nothing else matters. This is why we're here. Don't be here otherwise. This is why we're here. You say, well, that sounds like a lot. Just take a tiny step. Just take a tiny step. Do you know tiny steps are the only kind we know how to take? Just take a little tiny step. One, and then another, and then another, as we begin to participate together in this glorious work, as he fills us and fills Chicago and fills Grand Rapids and fills North America and fills the very cosmos. God is doing all these good things. Neil Cole, the author of Organic Church and Primal Fire, he says this: attendance on Sundays does not transform lives. Jesus within our hearts is what changes people. We cannot fill the world with Jesus until Jesus has filled us, until he has filled us. That is what all of this gifting starts with. That's how Paul closes this section, Ephesians 4:13, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. That's it. He's growing us up into Christ. He's making us grown-ups in Christ, that we would